You know, as kids, we loved it when adults would tell us stories. Well, you too can become a master storyteller today by listening to one of the best storytellers out there who's going to share with you secrets about how to do that and more. Stick around. Here's one of the recent stories that Neil has put out that I think is rather compelling. Take a moment, let's listen to that, and then we're going to come back to our discussion.
One of the most profound lessons about marketing that I ever learned was at the New Jersey State Fair. Now, I know it's Jersey, but the fair is tucked way up in the northwest corner of the state. And I don't think people realize how country it gets up there. And I was sort of hanging around this truck display where a car company was showing off its brand new full-size pickup. This was a real new thing for them. And they had a couple of gals giving out cowboy hats with the company logo on them to anybody that would be willing to take a walk around to the vehicle. And, you know, that kind of thing is kind of tough sledding for the young people that do it, even on a good day. But one of these young gals, man, she just had that magic touch. And along came a couple of tough old boys in bib overalls with long beards and trucker caps with a different car company logo on them. But that didn't stop her. And she said, "Hey, fellas, you want to come take a look at this brand new truck? I'll let you keep one of these hats." And the meaner looking of the two, just right in her face, just says, "I wouldn't get in that truck if you were handing out gold bars." And so she turns to the other fellow and says, "Oh, I've seen this before. He's scared. He's scared he's going to like it. And he'd rather be wrong than change his mind." And the friend turns to the first guy and says, "Is that true, Dale? Are you scared?" And Dale says, "I ain't scared." And so the young woman says, "Well, talk is cheap, Dale, but you can prove me wrong. You can just let me take you on a tour of the vehicle." And I'm thinking, "Oh, man, you're good. You're good." And I start to shadow the three of them because I want to hear her patter. So she's showing him this and that, and she opens the back door of this big behemoth, and she says, "Dale, look at the size of that back seat." And he says, "Is it big enough to have sex in?" And she goes, "I don't know. Let's check the owner's manual." And inside of about 10 minutes, those old boys are walking around that fair wearing those cowboy hats. Now, I've spent a long career in advertising, and I thought to myself, how many ads would I have had to show those old boys before they would wear those hats? I'm not sure I ever could have shown them enough. So I went up to this gal with great humility and I said, "I think you may be the best salesperson I've ever seen in my life." And she said, "I'm not a salesperson. I just love making friends." Yep. And that was the lesson.
Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy. I'm your host for today. And I have with me Neil Ford. Now, Neil, first of all, welcome to CISO Tradecraft.
Thank you. Thank you, G-Mark. It's really cool to be on.
Secondly, I got to tell you that this guy has put together some of the most compelling two-minute LinkedIn videos I have ever seen. If you are not connected to him on LinkedIn, do so. We'll put all that stuff in the show notes. Also, Neil Ford, F-O-A-R-D. But before you start going ahead and start surfing the internet for videos, you'll tell us a little bit about your background and kind of how you ended up here. And I think you even had a stint in cybersecurity, as I recall.
Well, a little bit tangentially. I spent 30 years in advertising, working on the creative end of, if you ever saw Mad Men, my job was sort of like Don Draper's job. And so I was not only crafting the messages that we would put forward on behalf of our clients, but it was my job also to sell those ideas to the clients. And that was really where most of the learning took place. It turns out that most people are not really good at knowing a good idea when they see it or hear it. And your listeners and viewers probably have the same difficulty. They go, how can they not choose this? And isn't it obvious how great this idea or this service is? No, people have to be sold. And we are, most of us, not great judges of what a good decision is. So what I spent a huge long career doing is learning how to persuade clients to do what is in their best interest. The CISO element that I had was I did
a long stint consulting with the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. And I had some marvelous experience with the people that used to run the cybersecurity operation for the Fed. And as you can imagine, G-Mark, I just want you to imagine what it would be like to have a breach at the Fed. Like, what does Monday look like after that happens? It is a very unpleasant place. And, you know, everybody's pointing fingers at each other. And so there was a strange dilemma that they had doing the operation where they were trying to, you know, deal with internet security, which was, how do we persuade people to take all of our training to stay up to date on how to avoid getting phished or hacked? And then how do we get them to not complain about the various protocols and procedures that are in place to make sure they don't get hacked? And, you know, they had to deal with the grumbling of how long it took to boot up your computers, you know, because of all of the safety systems. And it was a real education for me. Okay. So as you can imagine, it's very important for the CISO there to be able to persuade people in a way that they feel emotionally that we are committed to cybersecurity here, because the stakes are so high, because the devastation that would be left in the wake of a breach is so profound with such international ramifications that communicating this to the organization is a vital part of the job. And that's what I was there to help with. And I have to say, they embraced it with a really impressive level of enthusiasm, because they did understand that issue.
So that's excellent. So you pointed one word out there that I want to pick out, because I think it's going to be essential in storytelling, and that's the word emotion. As humans, we all know what we're supposed to do. We should all go out. We should be working out every morning. We should not be, you know, doing bad habits. We should be getting 8 hours of sleep and all the other good stuff. Save, invest, don't live beyond your means. And if we did that, we'd all have wonderfully happy lives. But in fact, reality and truths. And what causes people to change your behavior is not logic, for most of us anyway. It's something that happens on the emotional level. So is that kind of the key that ends up making an effective storyteller?
Well, I have to stop briefly to just compliment you on how well you put that. You're really good at this. You'll forgive me, because I went over a speed bump there when I stopped being the guest and started being a listener, you know. But you've nailed essentially the most important reason why storytelling matters, and that is that people do not make their decisions rationally. They think they do. Their neocortex is so developed, it's so clever, that they assume that they're making their own decisions. In fact, most decisions are made emotionally. There are very good reasons for this, because emotional decisions are arrived at quickly. If we had to take every decision we make and do a plus minus, you know, and put it onto a spreadsheet and analyze it, we would be exhausted. And so emotional decision-making is rapid decision-making. It's often equated with intuition, for example. Do I trust this person, you know, et cetera. So given this, it becomes vital that people like you and trust you, and that when they look at you, they do so admiringly. And very quickly, I want to do a special tactic for anybody that whenever they're telling a story for the purpose of communicating a business, let's just say any issue that you want to communicate and you want to have an emotional response to it, you should always remember, never make yourself the hero of your story. Because when you do that, when you brag about yourself or when you are the hero of your story, people immediately distrust what it is you're telling them, because they think that you're being A, self-aggrandizing, B, trying to con them. And there's a wonderful quote that I often repeat from George Orwell, which is, no autobiography is to be trusted if it gives a good account of oneself. Any autobiography that does not reveal something disgraceful cannot be trusted, because any life when looked on from the inside is just a series of defeats. So when you give a good account of yourself, you think people are looking at you admiringly. Wow, that's amazing. Good for you. No, they look at you with disbelief and jealousy. neither of which you want to be the emotional state that someone's in. Instead,
interest,
when you want to communicate something effectively, even if you are the hero of your story, always make it some about someone else and you are simply observing their admirable behavior. This is, trust me when I tell you this, I've made the mistake of saying to clients something that I did that I thought was impressive, and you could just read on their faces that they didn't believe you. And then I switched up, I pushed in the clutch, changed gears, and from then on, anytime I wanted to talk about something impressive, I would always make up somebody that it was about, and then tell the story as somebody who observed it. And what I discovered then over time was, oh, when you do that, suddenly you're standing next to them, next to the clients. You're shoulder to shoulder with them, and they're looking at you, and you're looking at them. Mark, have you ever had the experience of going in, at the rim of the Grand Canyon? You ever had that?
Not yet. It's on my list.
The Grand Canyon is one of those sites where you can, you know about it, you know that it's beautiful, but when you see it in person, you're still stunned. And one day, I was with a Boy Scout troop. I was a Boy Scout, and we'd all gone to the rim, and we'd all experienced it. And then I was sitting in the shade of the bus that we'd arrived on, and I was just watching people at the rim. And here's what I noticed every single time. People looked out at the view, and then they turned to each other to make sure that you were seeing it too. And when somebody went up to the rim by themselves, they always looked for someone else to share it with. And this is a human quality. It's not enough to admire the beauty. You have to share it to feel complete. It's only really pleasurable when you notice that somebody else sees it too. And when you tell a story where you are not the hero, rather you're pointing out someone else's admirable behavior, everybody gets to share that with you, and you get to share it with them. This is not to be underestimated. That's part of how to get an emotional response, is to don't tell a story to make yourself the hero. Tell a story to share something wonderful.
Now, a lot of times for us as CISOs, if we're briefing a board or executives, it's really hard to be the hero, right? The best you could hope to talk about is, well, we had no breaches in the last quarter of a month, whatever your time period is, or look how wisely we've spent our money and look how wonderful we've invested. But that would seem to violate your rules if we're talking about how great, but at least how great I did as a CISO.
Right.
Or is it okay to talk about how great my team is, or do we have to get more third party than that?
It is okay to talk about how great your team is, but let's pretend for a minute that you were the one that hired that person. What I would suggest is that you take no credit for hiring them, or if you do take credit for hiring them, you say it was entirely accidental that I discovered that they had this talent. When you're bragging about somebody else, remove yourself from the glow deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
I remember listening to, are you familiar with the term, a white shoe law firm?
I am not familiar with a white shoe law firm.
The term white shoe law firm comes from the idea that there was a time in the Ivy League where it was very popular for the undergraduates to wear white buckskin shoes. Not tennis shoes, but these sort of, you know, Oxford shoes that were made of white suede. And what it was indicative of was that the law firms they exclusively hired Ivy League students as a partner, you know, as future partners. And what characterized a white shoe law firm was, you know how they'll say, oh, a dream team, you know, they'll get you, they'll go into the courtroom and they'll bamboozle the jury and you'll get a not guilty verdict. A white shoe law firm would go, you're never going to see the inside of that courtroom because this case has been decided on the golf course with the judge. Okay. So case dismissed, not guilty. And what I love about the idea of the white shoe law firm is the notion that, brother, if you're seeing the inside of a courtroom, you've already taken the wrong attorneys. You've already picked the wrong firm. Now, I want you to equate that to what a CISO does. A CISO, a really good one, is like, yeah, you didn't even have a breach. You didn't even see the inside of the courtroom. That's how good we are. Not what did we do after the breach? Or, you know, we're taking the steps necessary to make sure that we never get to the phase where you notice I'm here. Okay. My job is to make sure you don't even remember that I'm on staff. And that's how you know how good I am. You never see the inside of a courtroom. And there's a kind of a funny thing, whether it's, you know, a hockey goalie or a CISO, you know, you want a very uneventful life. And I think there's a kind of a perverse thing that CISOs have to do in order to be effective communicators. Weirdly, you have to have an incredibly big ego. That is, you have to be so confident in what you do that you will not tolerate you won't allow yourself to be disrespected. The job you do is so vital. Every time you speak, you have to sort of remind them of what the stakes are. Because if they're not taking it seriously, the consequences can be vast and dire and can haunt you for years. You know,
so from that perspective, let me engage on that, because I hate to I'm not trying to interrupt or anything like that, but I got a bunch of ideas have been queuing up, and I'm trying to act like an audience member with questions that I would ask. So first of all, if I'm a CISO, first of all, you can't let them forget about you, because come budget time, they're going to say, yeah, why do we have all these security people?
Right.
And so you also have to balance that. So there has to be some humility from a personal perspective with a little bit of braggadocio from the professional perspective. And again, as they say, look what your team has done. And as Ross and I have talked about for years, security is a business of revenue protection. If you get viewed as a cost center, then you're no better than the employee restroom, which is why they have that super thin toilet paper you can see through, and why everybody wants the key to the executive washroom, because the Bears use that three-ply stuff, and so can you if you make the grade. But the other thing you're talking about, courtroom and things, there's just something in today's Wall Street Journal. More personal injury lawyers are chasing data breach settlements. And it's talking about how the TV lawyers, I think they refer to them as personal injury lawyers, are queuing up. So they've got automatic alerts. So as soon as some company indicates that they've had to disclose a breach, here comes your 8K or whatever, boom, all these lawsuits come filing in automatically. And now you've got to deal with the fact that from that perspective, your bigger threat axis may not be the damage that your attackers had caused, but the damage that the law firms can cause. It's a different element of your attack surface.
It's a funny thing about that, Mark. I can easily imagine a story that a CISO tells that starts with a profile of one of those attorneys. Okay. I want you to pick the worst of the worst, just the slimiest ambulance chaser, you know, somebody with a real reputation for being a douche waffle. And you just start your presentation by saying, I want to introduce you to somebody. This guy is famous for this. He did this and this. And you know what he's really praying for is the day you have a data breach so he can come after you. And my job is to make sure you never meet that guy. Now, how seriously do you take this?
Your job is to fund this situation. Although it does point out in the article, and it's also true, that a lot of times in cybersecurity, not a matter of if, but when. If you have a motivated enough and financed opponent,
you're
up against a national threat actor. So you got to be really careful, because now you're bordering on that little bit of braggadocio again.
Yeah.
Let's go back in general about story. Yeah, continue that one.
No, you're absolutely right.
Back into
that's the problem with the cybersecurity is that everybody, you know, of all of the things to invest in, you know, this is a growth market. We all know that, because the threat vectors are abundant, the bad actors are growing, the take is astonishing. So you're right, G Mark. It's not a question of if, it really is a question of when. And so you have to mitigate risk. That's the whole thing, is I can't keep you from getting cancer, but I can certainly protect you if you do. And I can also put into place a number of protocols where, you know, the risk factor is a lot lower. So to return to whatever value I can offer for your audience, it's that Storytelling is helpful in doing essentially what I think you've proposed, which is, look, we can't have to argue about being funded if we're going to take this project seriously. They cannot see it as washroom expense or some other, you know, difficulty, some other cost center. It has to be perceived as a mission critical part of doing business under conditions where you are walking into a hostile environment every day you turn the computers on. You know, you're in the jungle and, you know, nobody's going to fault you for getting ready for a leopard attack. So to go back to this storytelling, let's return to an observation you made before, which I think is kind of the nub of the whole thing, why storytelling matters. It's because people make decisions emotionally. There's a big difference when you say intellectually, I know that somebody's going to get sick from this disease versus my wife has that disease. There's a big difference. You know, there's a big difference between a school shooting and a school shooting that your child was in the building. There's a difference. And the difference is emotional connection. People feel it the way that they would feel heat from the sun. Your job, or let me rephrase that, the advantage of telling stories in communicating in business is people feel these things emotionally, the same way that when they watch a television show, they care about the characters. Did you ever watch The Office or, say, this show called Severance?
I'm the wrong guy to ask. I don't watch TV.
Oh, okay. Anyway.
But I'm sure a lot of these has, so speak to them.
Well, you know, when people watch television shows, they get emotionally invested because what the shows do is they introduce you to a character. You feel like you know them. When somebody gets excited about meeting an actor or an actress, they're not really excited about meeting the actor or actress. They're excited about meeting the character that they fell in love with. And it's a funny thing about that. They just can't disassociate the fact, you know, that that person was told where to stand, told what to say, dressed, given 24 takes, they picked the best one, and then, you know, all the marketing and so forth. They think that the actor just dreamt up the lines on their own. Well, you know, this is how people are. They don't sufficiently think things through to get past their emotional reactions. And it becomes really important that when you are trying to communicate, you give people a sense of the stakes. You do it by illustrating it with a story about what can happen or what they get protected from. You give them somebody to care about, which is, it can be anybody from a shareholder to the poor person who was the victim of the phishing attack in your building and now commits suicide because of the consequences.
Well, most of the stories that I recall from you that are up on there have happy endings. They're stories with morals. At the end, you find out that the guy gets the girl. Reno is protecting the village in Italy, and then everything else works out better, and someone's carrying it on, and things like that. So, sure, there's a lot of gloom and doom and horrible things that are out there, but all things being equal, let's face it. Going back to your concept of the idea, we go to the movies not to watch things with horrible, nasty endings. We don't want to walk out and be depressed for 2 weeks. We want to feel like we're lifted up a little bit. What's the importance of making your stories to the point where they actually create some sort of a positive emotion? Or is there times when you just really want to scare the bejeepers out of people and make them go ahead and write a big fat check for your security budget?
You're pointing out something useful, which is even in a horror movie, there needs to be hope at the end. You know, the protagonist has to survive. Very, like if in the movie Alien, the original movie, Alien, Sigourney Weaver survives, but so does the cat. And then in the subsequent Aliens movie, the little girl Newt, she survives too. And those dreadfully horrific horror movies and, you know, thrillers do is they leave you with a feeling of relief, you know, and relief. And in the stories that I tell, there's a specific reason why I'm trying to be upbeat all the time. And that is that our media whether it's online or whether it's social media or whether it's traditional broadcast, our media is a rage-baiting, divisive, occupying army trying to upset you and make you feel like you are under attack. And the reason they do that is because that drives engagement. You know, when people are enraged, they engage. And all that these companies want is your eyeballs. They don't care what your emotional state is afterwards. They don't give a damn about you. They are just chasing your attention and trying to get your data. And what I do is I look at that and I think, I don't want to be part of that. I want to be part of the antidote. I want to be part of the solution to remind people you're not, people in general are not as bad as we're being told. We're not all awful. You will often see people doing really nice things for others. An illustration I use, G. Mark, which I think is kind of amusing, but it's true, is that, okay, when I am on the freeway, you know, I'm on, let's say I'm taking the 405 south into Orange County. Okay. I'm going to pass or be passed by approximately 70 to 100,000 people on that trip. Just a simple 45-minute drive. 100,000 people. How many real douchebags do you think I encounter on that trip? Two? It's astonishing how few of them are dickish. The proportion is so small. Here we all hurtling along in these devices that shield us, right? And the opportunity to be nasty is so abundant. And yet, most people are pretty cool. Well, that's how we are. It's not news to say, you know, somebody at the health club opened the door for me. I got a very sweet smile from, you know, the woman at the counter at the supermarket. That wonderful young guy that returned my wallet. These are just not newsworthy. You know why? Because they're so common. And so what is often helpful is to say in a story, you know, there is hope. We're doing the right things. There's a reason to feel like, you know, I want you to know we're doing everything we can do humanly possible. It doesn't mean we're perfect, but it means you're protected as well as you can be. And
interesting. No. Yeah, you got to be thinking of stuff.
Can I add one last thing, G-Mark, and that is
please do.
There is a phrase that I love to repeat endlessly, and that is that life is a team sport. And guess what? Business 100% is a team sport. Your clients, your suppliers, your customers, yourself, your other employees, your bosses, we're all on the same team, man. And don't have such distrust all the time. I saw a wonderful thing. Warren Buffett was talking to an audience about the importance of reputation. And you know, Warren Buffett's just so old school. It's new again. Just, I love that.
He's 95 years old. He's allowed to be old school.
Yeah, yeah. But look at the pattern of success he had. He was just such the long investor. And he said he doesn't have a lot of meetings, but twice a year he would circulate this letter to all his major employees and say, our reputation is our stock in trade. We can lose money. We can actually lose a lot of money, and it's not going to kill us. What will kill us dead, is if we lose the trust of our customers, if we lose our reputation. What took me 37 years to gain, you can wreck in 37 minutes. We've got to sustain trust by always doing the right thing. Warren Buffett proves to me that the long game is the good game. The long game is the best game. And people want somebody they can trust. They love the idea that somebody's not trying to chisel them all the time. G-Mark, you've heard me tell the story before, probably about one of the best car dealers I ever saw, and the fact that his sort of phrase, his sort of motto is, I'll lose a little money to make a friend. Because I'll sell 11 cars to that person instead of one. And yeah, if I chisel somebody, I sold them a car and I killed them in the deal, and I made $2,000 instead of $500, but I'll never sell that person another car. Versus I'll sell them 11 cars and the service to keep the cars running. So that's the beauty of trust, is that it's super efficient. You don't have to pay for a new customer. You just have a, well, storytelling is, it's important to, in your stories, to communicate the values of trust, the long game, doing the right thing, taking a little bit of a loss in order to do the right thing, or to make sure that you're establishing a relationship. You know, business relationships, where business is a team sport. It's not if you're just in it for yourself, you're never really going to crack the big time. Whereas companies where they really try, like Warren Buffett's company and Charlie Munger, they were just peas in a pod when it came to doing the right thing or being trustworthy. They were always telling stories about people that they couldn't trust and people that they could, and the kind of employees that they used to hire. You know, getting back to the types of stories that you tell, I love companies that advertise for employees that don't so much advertise for customers as much as they do advertise for the people that they're looking to come work for them. Because when you advertise for a certain type of employee, you do in fact advertise for customers, because what you're saying to customers is, this is the type of people that work here. And if you've ever been on an airline or in a hotel or in a great restaurant, it's really the staff that tells the story. They can advertise all day long as much as you want, and it won't make as much of an impression as a fantastic waiter or a great counterperson or a terrific flight attendant or a rental car company where the person at the front, at the desk, is really trying to help you out. And
interesting.
When a company,
yeah, because I think
please, I'm sorry, keep going.
Yeah, let me seize on a couple of things. So, very, very good point. I fly Southwest a lot, and if you look at Herb Kelleher, the late Herb Kelleher, who started it out, he said most people go ahead and their MBAs say make the stockholders happy, and that's ultimately what you want to do, is all about that and getting the money. He says no. And I'm going to make my customers happy. I am going to make my employees happy. I'm going to make my employees feel so valued that they are going to treat their customers so well that the shareholders are going to love it. And I don't know enough about the details. I know that right now Elliott Group has a big chunk of Southwest stock. They're doing some massive changes to the airline that after 40 some odd years, it's changing. There's a customer who's probably flown close to 1,000 flights on Southwest in 25 years, which is saying a lot. It's kind of scary when you think about it. It's like, but wait a minute, you're taking away the last refuge place where people would sing the departure song. They will go ahead and make a little crown out of, well, they don't even have peanuts anymore, but the little mixer sticks. Hey, happy birthday for someone out here. And then just joke around a little bit. And it was because people love what they did.
Yeah.
And so as we convey that into our own leadership styles, because typically none of us are going to have tens of thousands of employees, but we are going to have teams. But as we communicate not only with them, the people that work for us, but also the people for whom we work, management, and then our peers. So this is where I think the storytelling might come in very, very handy. Is security awareness training has become almost a check in the box.
Yeah.
I've written a lot of training. I presented it before. I got a friend, Stu Sharman. He's got a company. He's around the corner and he's made $1 billion doing awareness training. But I think what really connects is not having to sit down and go ahead and get the check in the box, but to be brought and led through some story that's compelling, that you like almost don't want that one to end. That was great. I love it. Can I get another one? And in each one of those.
Yes.
Somebody is learning a key behavior. So when they go, wait a minute, I'm not going to click on that because I remember what happened from the story that Neil told. Yeah. And so I think that's where you get transformative change in people's behavior and things. I'm also unpacking a couple other things that have gone on to the stack here with all the great comments you had. And one of the things you're talking about is one of Cialdini. So if you're familiar, Dr. Robert Cialdini.
Oh, sure.
He's come up with his principles of persuasion. And one of them, of course, is reciprocity. I hold the first door, you hold the second door. I buy the first round, you get the second round. And it's part of the social glue, not just lubricant, but even glue that holds us together. Because if everybody were totally in it for themselves, it would fall apart pretty quickly because no one would have any trust. And so foundational to that trust are thinking things like this reciprocity and commitment and following through and things like that. And the last idea I had that is kind of stacked up in my brain stack here was the concept of emotions being a way to get to people. At Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, was a great book. It was published in 2011, and it talks about how we come up with a very immediate perception on something, but then given a chance to think through it, we end up with a different result. And in the world of phishing, hacking, et cetera, the attackers know that if I can create an immediate emotional state that's going to be transient, but get you to do something that you wouldn't do if you thought about it, that's how the bad guys win. So in a way, what we're trying to do is craft messages to get people to stop, think, count to 10. There's nothing, if it came in an email, by definition, it can't be super important because that's a store and forward network. Now, if the phone rings and it's your boss and says, get in here right now, off you go. But trying to convince people to change their behavior, which there's a lot of things that we can do, but in my opinion, being able to have compelling ways of creating a narrative and conveying that narrative. And so, again, that's why I've asked you to come on the show, because I thought you've done a spectacular job of that. And I know you've got your own course out there called StoryFire, and we're not exchanging any money here. So, but I still think it's very compelling. I went ahead and I spent money on it because I just thought it was great to learn from a master. But what is it that you teach people to become better storytellers? And then more specifically for the audience that we have, cybersecurity professionals, people looking to work their way up the executive suite, any way you can tune those observations to this audience?
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, so much to talk about there. It's kind of funny, G. Margaret. I wish we had like another hour to tack on to this to really dig in. Let me go right to the sort of tactically things that I teach in StoryFire. Here's one that people vastly underestimate. That is that you are a brand, okay? Everybody that's listening and watching your show, you are a brand, ladies and gentlemen. That is, you can be searched out in 24 seconds, and I can find out a lot about you by using Google, by using Perplexity or ChatGPT. I can find you on LinkedIn, and I can learn all about you, at least superficially. Now, if you make a habit of creating content, whether that is written stories or videos or recordings or anything like that, and it reflects values that you believe in, then when people look you up, they're seeing, hearing, and reading what you want them to hear so that they know you. One of the problems that people have with anybody they're doing business with is they can't trust you until they get a sense of who you are. Face-to-face, meetings are a terrific opportunity for us not just to take someone's measure from the articulable resume standpoint, but get your measure from how do they feel about you? What's the vibe you give off and so forth? Okay, now you're a brand. Just accept that. You can be looked up, people can find you, and then they're going to make a judgment about you. How impressive do they find you and so forth? Under these circumstances, it is to your advantage to be out there in the world, saying the things that you believe in and sharing things. Now, one of the things that everybody should recognize is that if you are a brand, it's kind of weirdly not about you. It's about the people you celebrate. It's about the ideas that you want to share. And this is one of the things that's really important to me in my StoryFy courses. Every time you open your mouth, it should be a gift to somebody. In the same way that this car dealer said, I'll lose a little money to make a friend. It's, how about if we have a relationship first? Let me do you a favor. And in doing so, you feel like we could be friends. And in the car business, this guy said, man, the number one thing I want them to think is, I got a guy. In the car business, I got a guy. I got somebody I go to, the default decision, boom, You know, I don't even have to think about it. Okay, that's a beautiful place to be. Now, one of the principles in storytelling is, you know, there's, well, what kinds of stories should I tell? Well, StoryFire gets into, you know, all the possible places that you can draw stories from. But the number one place is you have your own personal experience of things that you've run into. Now, CISOs have a lot of experience in the right places to tell the stories about this can happen to you, or this is how I avoided this, or here's somebody in the business whose conclusions I admire. This is where I go for information. I trust this person's judgment. You did it a second ago, G. Mark, when you were talking about the books you were reading, like, you know, Thinking Fast and Slow. This is a gift to your audience, because now they get to look that up and see whether maybe that's a good source of information. Okay. So in StoryFire, it's all about, like, let's talk about how if you're just default, you're a brand, whether you like it or not, let's make sure that you're out there in the world being that brand and, you know, doing the things that help people understand who you are and feeling good about yourself. There's a rule we used to have in advertising, which was, it was the most fundamental rule of how to shape and help a brand along. And that is, life gets so much easier when people like you. When people like you, they want you to win. They want to help you when you ask for it. And they want to be next to you. And they want to go through this adventure together. You know, it's a funny thing. You notice how people have brands on their shirts or on their shoes, or, you know, I'm wearing a Vans shirt.
You're wearing yours, I'm wearing mine.
Yeah, well, there you go. And when people put on a Nike swoosh, it isn't because, you know, they happen to like the shape. It's a variety of emotional reasons why they adopt that, why they drive the cars they do and so forth. But when, if you acknowledge, okay, I'm a brand, and I'd like for any time they encounter me to feel a certain kind of way, well, give them that feeling. You know, tell stories about the things that you believe. So I'll give you one example. As I was saying a second ago, that it's my belief that our media is a kind of an occupying army trying to divide us. By splitting us into teams, now it's almost like it's a horse race now. You know, who's going to win? And now they get to report. The media is just trying to engage your attention. All right. Well, I want to be the voice saying, you know what? We're not all at each other's throats. We're not all bad, as you're being told. We're actually very, very remarkably similar. There are more of us in agreement than in disagreement. Don't let them tell you we're all so awful and that you're surrounded by people that hate you. All right. When I go out there in the world and I say these messages, I find that the people that reach out to me to talk more, like you, they're really cool. The people that reach out to me, G-Mark, are cool people because they believe the same stuff. You know, knock wood, nobody has ever stiffed me on a speaking engagement yet. And the reason is, yeah, because I'm not talking to douche nozzles, because douche nozzles don't like me. Cool people like me, nice people like me. And when you are out there trying to make sure that the stories you tell are a gift to the person you're in your audience, when you're trying to reassure them, you know what, don't worry, there is a way to be relatively safe more than otherwise. I do have an appreciation for the bad actors that are after us, you know, the various literally armies who are trying to attack vector us. Okay, I'm trying to help you out. We're all on the same team. Okay, you can, by being that person, and they get a good sense of you, they go, that's the kind of person I want to do business with. That's the kind of person I want to have a beer with. Well, consider the advantage to you as a CISO if they like your company. Now, let me just add one extra thing. There's a marvelous quote. I don't know the origin of this, but it is, the quote is, students are not vessels to be filled. They are torches to be lit. The most important thing a teacher can do at any level is to get you excited about the topic. Because your excitement about the topic will ignite further exploration. Nobody learns anything they don't want to learn. Or let me rephrase that, because sometimes a bad lesson is a very deeply learned lesson. You know what I mean? Like the mistakes we make are often incredibly instructive. What I mean is nobody will believe something they don't want to believe. And you'll see this again and again in the fact that we go into our echo chambers politically. You know, we just don't want to hear the opposite opinion, so we wind up listening to only those opinions that match our own. It's really vital for anybody in your audience, G. Mark, to say, all right, well, if I was going to take this seriously and I want to actually get good at when I speak to people, I can reach their emotions. Like, how do I do that? Here's the number one tip. Practice. Practice. There's a wonderful quote from David Mamet where he says, you want to get good at writing plays, then write a play, put it on in front of an audience, and get humiliated. And you just have to get used to the fact that if you're ever going to get good at something, you have to be willing to push through being bad at something at first. Everybody, when they start out, is a terrible ice skater. Everybody is a terrible archer, bow and arrow. Everybody is a terrible swimmer. At first, it's the ability to withstand not being good for a while that turns you pro. And this device that we all have lets you rehearse by filming yourself telling a story, watching it back, cringing, getting over it, improving, and doing it again. And we really have been given a great gift with our devices, because if you can record yourself telling a story, then you can get better. And if you can, the day that you stop cringing when you want, you know, you get, G Mark, you guys know this. It's like, oh, I hate the sound of my voice, or I can't stand how I look on camera. Well, get over it. Get over it. Nobody else sees it. You just what? You're in the,
and
you're dancing.
And you get used to it.
You get used to it.
It doesn't bother you anymore.
Yeah. And the day it stops bothering you, that's the day you turn pro. And the day you turn pro is the day you are a relentless self-improver. A relentless self-improver is impossible to beat over time because they never stop getting better. That was Toyota's secret, Kaizen, continuous improvement. You don't have to be perfect now. You just have to be in pursuit of perfection. You'll never be perfect, but you're in pursuit of it. And it's magical. It's the accumulated interest. You know, 1% better a year? Man, you're really good by the end of a couple of years.
I had Andy Ellis on my show a while back, and he has a book called 1% Leadership. And he says, if you can get 1% better every day,
yeah,
how much better are you at the end of a year?
Holy, yeah.
Imagine. And you're not one point. I just did the thing on my calculator. You know, 1.01 to the 365th power is 37.78. So you are 3,700% of where you were. Now,
yeah,
daily improvement is really a tall order, but the idea is you can aspire to that. And whether it is in your professional knowledge, as I've written many years ago, G. Mark's Law, half of what you know about security will be obsolete in 18 months. All those Windows 10 boxes in your enterprise are going to be obsolete in October. And that's coming up pretty quickly, so you better have a plan for upgrading those. And then a year and a half ago, hardly any of us are using a ChatGPT, and now pretty much everybody is. And 18 months from now, the biggest thing, we probably haven't even heard of it yet. And so for people who want to make a career of cybersecurity, they have to dedicate themselves to that constant learning. They're always reinventing themselves. They're gaining knowledge. They're not, hey, let's go out for a beer, but hey, let me read one more thing, or let me take a look at that. Or maybe drink your beer with a buddy while you're going ahead and doing some testing or hacking or something like that. We have a community of people that we thrive because we are constantly evolving at least as fast is our environment around us. And our environment around us is evolving at the speed of 7 billion humans who are contributing to whatever society throws at us. And you're supposed to keep up. And if you can, then you're able to remain relevant. And by remaining relevant, other people who are struggling to keep up will turn to you and say, wow, that guy's onto something, or she's got some insight. And this is where your influence comes from. Being a persuasive speaker is helpful, but it's a necessary but not sufficient condition. And some would say, it's not even necessary for success. You've heard politicians and you wonder, how in the world do they even order at a drive-through, let alone get elected to some high-level office? And of course, the whole machinery that they've got behind them is what propels them up there, and pay no attention to that person standing in front of the curtain. Rather, those of us who don't have a gigantic machine propelling us forward have to rely on skills and capabilities that we inculcate in ourselves. And from my experience and reason reaching out to you, is chief among them is the ability to be an effective communicator. Communicating in stories has worked for centuries. It's why we have things like the Iliad and the Odyssey, because those are passed on by oral tradition. And if you remember your dactylic hexameter and your iambic pentameter and all the things they used to learn in Latin class, it had a rhythm. It had a cadence to it that made it memorable. And yeah, I would encourage anybody who wants more to go ahead. I'll put some links here in the show notes about how to follow up with Neil and learn a little bit more and perhaps improve your storytelling as well, because I think that in becoming persuasive, you become more effective. And becoming more effective, you're able to go ahead and accomplish those things that we consider to be good. Maybe I've got some APTs listening to my podcast figuring out how do we hack better. All right, well, hello out there, all you quote-unquote bad guys. But most of it, I think, are the good folks listening in.
Well, there's a significant thing that people need to keep in mind, which is nobody's saying you have to be the best storyteller in the world for it to be an advantage to you. You just have to be a little bit better than you were before. Now, the example I use is useful tools during the zombie apocalypse. So, you know, we would all agree that a loaded shotgun is very useful in the zombie apocalypse, but of even greater value is a slower companion. And the idea is, in a competitive world, you don't have to be Usain Bolt. You just have to be faster than the dude next to you. And so in the art of storytelling as a means of advancing your agenda and as a CISO, you don't have to be the best in the world. You just have to be better than you were and maybe better than the guy next to you. But it doesn't mean torpedoing anybody next to you. It does mean, as an organization, trying to get everybody to get better. You know, I don't know, G-Mark, if people know you were a Navy captain, but that is a hell of an impressive rank to have achieved in the United States Navy. And there are things that you know that you don't even know you know from that experience. But let's just agree on this. You had to learn to be the ultimate teammate. We are all on the same team here, ladies and gentlemen. It is one team. And I have to, as a captain, I have to support and grow and bring to the next year the new leaders to take over for when I'm gone. And that is a very significant thing in any organization, is to have a mindset of, it's not just that I want to get better. I want everybody around me to get better. And in doing so, you know, there won't be any slower companions on our team. Or even if they are.
That's some great insight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because from like a technical perspective, we want to do better. We want to be smart. We want to do better. But as a leader, your career reputation is not how great you are. It's how well the people who are assigned to you did.
Yeah.
Did you take people who are on this track and fast track them? Did they find out that by being under your tutelage or working with you, that all of a sudden their career made a little bit of a move up? All of a sudden people, they want to come work for you. And then you have a little bit of ability in a lot of cases, not always in the military. You don't get to pick your crew. It's assigned to you. But over here in the real world, you do get to pick your folks. And those who say, I really want to work with this person because Neil is amazing, and the people who go work for Neil have a higher than average promotion rate. They do better. They're happier. They learn things. They do things. And that's what we can reflect as our legacy as leaders, is that we have left behind not an improved technical situation, but an improved mini society, if you will, where people can take that same culture. Message.
Yeah.
Then the culture, and then they too become those mentors. And then it grows on and it perpetuates.
I want to say that is part of the story you tell. In other words, your actions tell a story. And when you are supportive of the people that work for you, that when you are developing their talent and looking out for their career trajectory, you are telling the story of what it is to be a leader here. When it comes to raising children, there's what you say and there's what they see you do. And they are watching and listening to everything that comes out of your mouth. And it's staggering the things your children will tell you about what they noticed. And when you set an example, like, for example, the advice I got from my father-in-law about when I had a daughter who's now in her 20s, he said, the way you behave towards your daughter and towards your wife, her mother, is going to determine what she thinks a man is. So she's never going to settle for less than what you represent as a man. And man, when you find that out as a father, it's like, oh, every move I make has to serve as an example of what a man is to my daughter, so that years from now, I know she won't put up with this and that and the other behavior. Well, everybody has to have that same attitude as a leader in any business, is to say, I'm modeling the next generation of leaders for this company by the way I behave, the things I say, the concerns I have. And the type of stories you tell, it's not so much how you tell a story, it's what story did you choose to tell that really tells me about you. Is that message upbeat? Is that message self-aggrandizing? Is it humble bragging? Or is it legitimately gracious and generous? Does it communicate values of togetherness and team spirit and generosity? Or does it celebrate victimization of others? Did you see that thing that's a meme on the web right now? It's some CEO, I don't know if it's a Polish company, whatever, and he was at the U.S. Open. One of the tennis players autographed a hat and handed it to a kid, and the man snatched it away from the kid and then stuffed it in his wife's bag. Did you see this?
I had not seen that.
Oh, well, it's like that guy got a blowback of Olympic proportions. I mean, he got dragged online. At first, he doubled down saying, hey, if you're not fast enough, that's your problem. Okay. And then, boy, then the sharks really came out and smelled blood in the water and went after him. And it started affecting his business. And then he issued an apology. Like, every move this guy makes is a douche move. Every single thing he does is typical of a sociopath. And all of it is storytelling.
And it's interesting you talk about that. I had heard, I can't remember where it was talking about different psychological profiles. And I said, there's a disproportionate number of sociopaths in the executive suite. And I mean, I did my MBA at a Jesuit school. And so perhaps I have a slightly different viewpoint where when you create a job opportunity, you're supporting somebody's family. That's how their kids are going to go to school. That's how they're going to eat. That's how their house gets paid for. And that's a sort of a sacred trust that you have, rather than let's squeeze our employees, let's squeeze our suppliers, let's squeeze our customers and take the maximum profit and keep it for ourselves as a bonus. And that's a perfectly legitimate way to run a business. And if we take a look, though, at stories, we see something like that and we see somebody's behavior. There may be people who say, yeah, good for you, you win. Somebody else might say, it's a kid, but the kid be happy. And there's everything in between. But as you pointed out, our behavior conveys ultimately who we are. If we are in our own skin doing good for others, then that becomes who you are. You've got concerns about your character and your reputation. Your reputation, people could try to go ahead and create a false reputation. Oh, he's a liar, he's a cheater, stealer. But your character is going to be what people are going to see over time. And they say, wait a minute, this Neil guy, he's not so bad. And he's actually pretty decent. And I don't know why they said all these horrible things about him. And today, with all of the internet trolls that are out there, where you don't have to worry about getting punched in the nose like you would in a bar when you walk up to somebody and said, hey, you're ugly and your mom addresses you funny, then we have lost an awful lot of that social respect, and the discourse has just become so so negative. So I encourage people, don't engage in that. Assume that everything you post on social media or even on LinkedIn, or if you go, don't give a thumbs up on something that is in bad taste. Even if you laughed about it, laugh in private. But if it's something that's a positive story, if it moves something forward, be known for that, because people can see pretty easily everything that you posted, but also everything you commented on. And then that becomes your extension of your identity. And as a result, that is how people are going to ultimately determine what they're going to think of you, unless they happen to have the opportunity to sit down face-to-face over an adult beverage, which at some point in time, I'm looking forward to do that, but we're on opposite coast right now. You just have to wait for the planets to line up.
Yeah. It's,
so what do you think? Anything we didn't cover, anything you'd like to mention, anything you think would be good words of wisdom to leave behind as a master storyteller, but also somebody who's been in marketing for years?
Well, even though I have nothing to do with selling Dale Carnegie books, I think that if I were starting out in business, I think the one thing that I would want to do is read Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People.
And 1937.
Yeah, there's a couple of reasons why I think that's a good book to read. One is that when a book is almost 100 years old and you read it and you think, wow, this is still true. When something is almost 100 years old and it's still true, that's because it's always going to be true. And knowing, you know, very early true stuff, like things that are perpetually true, is incredibly useful. The second thing is Carnegie is what he seized on that's true is that you can get almost anything you want by helping other people get what they want. But that book is a really quite a brilliant book. I take an enormous amount of inspiration from Dale Carnegie when I have done my own Storyfire course, because it is my belief that ultimately where storytelling is of tremendous value is by persuading people that they're not alone, that we're all on a journey. We're in this together. And to the extent that you can help other people realize they're not alone and don't feel lonely and don't feel isolated and don't feel put upon and don't feel distrustful, it's a wonderful gift that you can give, and ultimately one that pays a lot of dividends. Mark, I was at this professional speakers thing in Scottsdale. Now, I went there to learn tips and tricks on how to gin up more business for my professional speaking. But I walked away with a dividend that I didn't expect. I didn't see it coming, and it was the number one lesson I walked away with, which was that place, there were about 1,000 people there, and they were all extroverts. So what happens is you roll into the building, everybody's eyes up, right? Nobody's looking at their phones. We're all walking around the hallways. Everybody's eyes up and we're all saying hi to each other, and everybody's got a big smile on their face. And you are starting conversations with strangers at Starbucks, and you are starting conversations with strangers over lunch. They make sure there's no seating arrangement for all of the lunch. Everybody just sits down with everybody else. And brother, it was a revelation. Every time I got on the elevator, somebody started a conversation with me. It was glorious. And here's what happened. 3 days of that, I was an extrovert. I didn't see it coming. They infect you. By the end of the 3 days, I was the one starting the conversation on the elevator. I was the one saying, so are you from Scottsdale, or are you part of this thing? It was just the most natural thing in the world. And what happens, I believe, is that when people grow accustomed to telling stories in business, they start perceiving the world as a resource for stories, which is they go through the world differently. They are much more observant. They're looking for things to share. Every time they have a little bit of a setback with the cable company or the car repair, this is my experience, you don't look on it as a great tragedy. You look on it as, well, this will be the source of the story, I'm pretty sure. Like, what's this tow truck driver's story? What's his deal? You know, and that is a wonderful place to be, is when you start telling stories and you start looking for stories, you start living differently and you start being open to everything that happens to you as the source of a possible learning event. So there you go. I'll leave you with that.
That sounds great. So I think with that, we've probably use up our time on our shot clock, although you're right, I could probably keep doing this for another hour or two, because most of the time I'm just listening and watching you do the masterful story stuff. So for those who are watching or listening, if you haven't heard of Neil Ford, F-O-A-R-D, you can find him on LinkedIn. Go ahead and connect there or follow him and then look at some of his videos, and I think you'll be convinced. And of course, I'm saying you're always out there in a suit with a nice little
pocket square.
Something in your pocket, the pocket square and the black background. Now you can see the black background here because I'm thinking like, well, I got this cluttered background here and the light, but they're masterful. And you have this tool called StoryFire. So I'll put a link down there in the show notes for StoryFire.net if people want to go ahead and learn a little bit more about how to tell stories better. And I think it's one of the skill sets that will help you over life, over time, not only in your job, but also with your kids. And when you get to the point with grandkids, because we all remember when we were little, tell me a story. And those who could tell stories were able to captivate the imaginations of kids. And at heart, we're still all kids. We still want to hear a story. And as a result, for those of us who are good storytellers, we'll still have people following us around. So this is your host, G. Mark Hardy. Thank you for tuning in to CISO Tradecraft. If you like our podcast, don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn if you're not doing so already. We do a lot more than podcasts. We have a high signal, low noise set of information coming out. We also have videos, little short ones we'll put out from time to time. And you can go ahead and follow us on our own little newsletter. And so until next time, stay safe out there.